Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston. So there are many, many forms of justice: economic, political justice, social justice, educational justice, but all of them are interrelated. So it's so important for us as individuals and as organizations, businesses, institutions, that we use our power and platform to really stand on the right side of justice to create a world that is just for all. So thank you very much for joining us today. Welcome to the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston, and we're going to focus on economic justice today. Today, we have attorney Francisca D. Fajana, who is senior counsel for Latino Justice, which is formerly known as the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund. She is an ardent advocate for lawyering at the intersection of structural racialization and poverty. Fran is a senior counsel with decades of experience litigating civil rights, collateral consequences of criminal records, consumer and housing cases. Fran has successfully pursued cases of import in federal district courts, including holding a housing authority accountable for condoning a racially hostile housing environment and participating in litigation challenging unconstitutional revocation of driver's license for non-payment of court debts. Fran also has successfully advanced policy reform, expanding opportunities for people with criminal histories, and written extensively about the subject. Attorney Fran holds an LLM from Boston College Law School and a JD from Suffolk University Law School. And welcome to the Empowerment Zone, Attorney Francisca. I'm so happy to have you. And her topic today is economic justice, education, and employment advocacy. So how are you today, Attorney Fran?
I'm very good, Ramona. And please call me just Fran. You don't need to call me attorney. So thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, thank you. As I stated to you before I called, your colleague really speaks very highly of you. So I am so happy to have you on the show today, and especially with the era that we're currently living in terms of an era of social and racial justice that our country is really wrestling with some very serious issues. And our expectation is that we're in a moment of transformational change in the United States and in our world. I know in terms of your organization, where you work, Latino Justice is really focused on creating a more just society through using the law. And so you have a wealth of information, I know, to share with us about how to create a more equitable society. So before we get started on your topic, can you give our audience a little bit of information about you and your background, and just tell us a little bit about you personally and professionally before we get into this serious topic?
Oh, where to start? So I've been a lawyer now for almost 28 years. I live in Massachusetts, in Worcester, Massachusetts, although I work for Latino Justice, which is a civil rights organization that's based principally in New York, but has an office in Florida, and also does work in the South. I was actually born and raised in Nigeria, which is in West Africa, but I've lived here for well over 30 years. I decided to go to law school because it was something that my mother always wanted me to do. But as a somewhat of a, I wouldn't call myself rebellious, but when I was much younger, it wasn't necessarily the path that I wanted to follow. But after I graduated from undergrad and thought about going to graduate school, it just seemed to me that law school might be the path to follow. And so I applied and got into law school. And in terms of my civil rights advocacy, in law school, I got exposed, as most law students do, to the area of law called constitutional law. And I was really taken aback by the number of civil rights cases that stalwarts of the civil rights movements like Thurgood Marshall had brought. And I was struck in particular by the Dred Scott decision, which is this decision that was issued in 1857 that essentially made Black people non-human. And I was initially drawn to law school because I wanted to pursue immigration law. But after my experience with constitutional law, it just seemed really clear to me that civil rights work and anti-poverty work was really my calling. And since I graduated from law school, even when I was in law school as an intern, working for organizations that focus on the intersection of poverty and race, which I was just drawn to those organizations. I worked for a local legal services organization for about 8 years and then worked for another one that focuses mostly on law reform for well over a decade. And then I came to Latino justice. So that's my trajectory in a nutshell.
Wow. And it's amazing that your mom was pushing you in that way. And even though you rebelled a little while, you still made it toward that direction. I'm sure your mom would be pleased to hear this.
Yeah, she's gone now, but
yes.
She lived to see me go to law school and be a lawyer. So
that's good. That's good. Congratulations. And so when we're talking about, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the Dred Scott decision, particularly in this moment, because, you know, that's the reason that we have to have these efforts to create justice is because a large segment of the American community has not been considered human, and that is embedded in the law. And because it's embedded in the law, it's embedded in the way we're socialized here in the United States. And so that is a great place to begin a conversation, even beyond that, when you look at the institution, the development of the institution of slavery in the U.S., you understand the dehumanization of a particular group of people, specifically people of African descent. So let's move on into the economic justice component of your work at Latino Justice. What is it that you do as a lawyer in terms of addressing that particular issue?
So Latino Justice has been around for almost 50 years. And in that time frame has done a lot of work on voting rights issues and in a number of other spheres. And have always had a focus on education. But over the last several years, we now have four pillars in which we sort of do most of our work. Voting rights, criminal justice, economic justice, and we have a pillar, immigrant rights, and then we also have a pillar that focuses almost exclusively on the work in Puerto Rico, because we used to be called the Puerto Rico Legal Defense and Education Fund. In terms of our economic justice work, as you read from my bio, I have an ecliptic interest in a variety of different areas of law. But in terms of our economic justice work, I tend to look at it as a pillar that has a three-legged stool, and it consists of employment, education, and housing. So those three pillars, those three components from my vantage make up our economic justice work, because I I tend to believe that you need those three components in order to access the what we tend to refer to as the American dream. In order to be self-sufficient, that you need to be somewhat successful in those three spheres. You need to have a good education. You need to have a good employment. You need to live in, you know, have decent housing, to have, you know, economic stability, and have economic justice. So in those three components, my work focuses mostly on bringing litigation. Before I came to Latino Justice, I did a lot of policy advocacy and legislative advocacy, but at Latino Justice, I've mostly focused on bringing litigation. So in the employment sphere, for example, we bring litigation on behalf of individuals, particularly low-wage workers who are Latinx, because we mostly focus on the Latin, not exclusively, but we mostly focus on work on behalf of the Latinx community. So bring litigation on behalf of an individual or individuals who are being denied employment opportunity or have employment opportunity and they're being denied benefits in terms of where they work. So one example would be a recent case that I co-counseled with one of my colleagues on behalf of a pregnant woman who experienced, so she had a job, she worked in the hospitality industry, and she was denied promotion because she was pregnant, and also experienced what the law classifies as a hostile work environment. And on top of that, the state of New York mandates that individuals who are pregnant are entitled to what they call short-term disability. She was denied that disability as well. And this is, a low-wage worker who is also not English proficient. So that particular case we filed in federal court and ultimately settled the case. That's just one example of the employment work that we do. And in bringing the case, our client, who fortunately was able to get had another job, also got some monetary compensation. So that's one way that you could call it empowerment, but it's also compensating an individual for the harm that she suffered. In the education sphere, our work is, Latino Justice has had a history of doing education work, particularly on behalf of the Latinx community and around bilingual education and limited English proficiency. But more recently, we've been looking more closely at the elite high schools. So these are opportunities for, help promote more college access. I mean, if there's some overall vision in terms of our education work, at least from my vantage, is to help struggling schools, help students in struggling schools do better. College readiness is sort of the way I see, if I have to encapsulate our education advocacy in one or two words, it's really getting kids to be college ready. Whether college is a four-year institution or a two-year college, that's left to individual students and their families to sort of determine. But we've been paying a lot of attention or close attention to the elite schools, elite high schools, elite public high schools, really. And so I'll give you three quick examples. So in the state of, in New York City, for example, there are eight specialized, they call them specialized high schools, but they're elite high schools that are pipeline to getting into some of the more prestigious and colleges. The Latinx and African-American population in the entire New York City public school system is close to 70%, about 67% or thereabouts. But Latinx and African-American students combined are 11% of students who are getting into this eight elite schools that are publicly funded institutions. There's a pending litigation right now in New York that were brought by a number of parents who alleged that the cities made modifications to the criteria for entering a summer program, that's sort of a feeder program for kids getting into the specialized high school. The city had sort of made some modifications to look more closely at socioeconomic indicators as a way to promote the number of kids who are getting into the summer program that then prepares them to get into the specialized high schools. And so there's litigation pending against the city by white and Asian American parents, families, and Latino Justice and a number of other civil rights organizations have sort of intervened in that case to amplify the voices of Latinx students and African-American students who are really underrepresented in the public schools. We have the same kind of situation also playing out in Boston, Massachusetts. Unlike New York City, Boston has three exam schools, again, publicly funded institutions. The Latinx and African-American public school population is again close to 70%. But in one of the elite public schools, public high schools in Boston, African-American and Latinx students are about 21% of the population. They're almost 70% of the public school system, but 21% in this particular school. In New York City, they're almost 70% of the public school population, but 11% in all the eight specialized high schools combined. So talk about college readiness and talk about a publicly available and accessible good not being equitably distributed. And then last but not least, there's also a very similar dynamics playing out in Fairfax County, Virginia. Again, African-American and Latinx students are about maybe 38% of the Fairfax County public school population, but they're about 4% of students admitted to the Fairfax County Public Schools. It's called the Thomas Jefferson Public High School for Science and Technology. African-American and Latinx students combined are about 4% of the population. So you do the math and see how, whether or not things are being equitably distributed. So that's sort of been our focus in terms of our education advocacy.
Wow. And I'm sure, even though you highlighted the cases that you have in New York City, Boston, and Fairfax County, Virginia, that this is something that goes on all over the country, and that we really have to address the access to education and educational opportunity in order to move justice forward, right? These percentages are outrageous, being 70 to 80% of the school system, a public school system, yet the elite institutions within that system, you rarely have access, less than 11%, 12, 21%, and 4%, which is really some low numbers. And these institutions are extremely important in getting access to college or college readiness, as you stated. So how do these cases come to your attention? Are you seeking them out? Are you looking where there is inequities, or are people coming and bringing these to your attention? How are you getting involved in terms of litigation with these cases?
Very good. That's a really good question. So in terms of the New York City, the litigation in New York City, that was brought to Latino Justice's attention because, as I said, we've had a history of paying attention to educational inequities, particularly as it affects Latinx students, whether it's in bilingual education or other access to education. And so that was brought to our attention because we have a relationship with our sister civil rights organizations and had actually brought a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights many years ago. This complaint actually predated my tenure at Latino Justice. And And so, and the other reality is that the what was going on at the specialized high schools in New York City was all over the news. So sometimes that's one way that we become abreast of what the issues are is, you know, we all get news, you know, alerts and read the local papers and see what's going on. But that in New York City, because we've had this collaboration with the with our sister organizations and it had litigation pending, we sort of were monitoring what was going on with the specialized high schools. So as soon as this litigation was brought, we geared up to make sure that the voices of Latinx and African-American students were also being included in the consideration of who's getting access and who's been excluded and who should, you know, all have equitable access to this public good. And then the litigation in Boston was actually brought to attention by, you know, local organizations who care about the Latinx and African-American population. And if memory serves me well, I think we were, somebody reached out to us from the NAACP local NAACP chapter in Boston to say, you know, this is what's going on. And obviously, having looked at the complaints, it sort of resonated with what's going on in New York. And then the Fairfax County one, we also got, I actually got an email saying, are you aware that this is what's going on in Fairfax County as well? I was like, okay. You know, it's the same dynamic playing out in different places. And we expect this dynamic to possibly continue. I mean, I understand that there is very similar litigation as well in California, but we're not necessarily right now involved in that particular litigation.
Yeah. You know, when you look at public education, it's really disheartening that, you know, we contribute to the tax dollars that pay for these institutions, and yet we don't have access to them. So you talked about economic justice being composed of three pillars, education, employment, and housing. So can you elaborate on the work that you're doing in the areas of employment and housing in terms of moving the needle forward in, for justice?
In terms of employment, I think it's mostly, you know, bringing litigation, and I described at least one case that we've worked on and have a few others actually in the pipeline that I probably
should not talk about.
One that I can probably talk about because it's already filed. It's newly filed. But our goal is to ensure that the rights of African Americans, the rights of Latinx clients, Latinx workers, particularly female workers in certain industries are protected, and that their rights, you know, the rights that they're afforded under Title VII in particular, which protects or prohibits discrimination in employment, that those rights are being respected. And so we have, you know, a lawsuit that we just recently filed last month, I believe. And then we have a few others in the pipeline. But our goal is really to ensure that, folks have a right to access certain jobs, and that when they are on those jobs, they are not experiencing national origin and or ethnicity or race-based discrimination. In terms of housing,
before you go to housing, I would make the argument that most people, I would say most people of color, African Americans and Latinos have challenges on their job, you know? So how are you and are experiencing discrimination on a daily basis? So how do you determine which cases to litigate? I mean, it's an everyday occurrence. That's the reality of the situation. You know that African Americans and Latinos aren't considered for certain jobs. They're denied promotion. You know, they don't have access to certain types of employment. So This is systemic. This is a systemic issue, as well as all the other issues that you discussed. So how do you determine how you're going to use your energy and what cases you take to the court system?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that in my tenure thus far at Latino Justice, I've been there, this is going on my third year. I think that the criteria that we tend is most controlling or maybe prevalent for us is whether or not the individual is a low-wage worker. A low-wage worker who more likely than not is not going to be able to get representation in the private sphere. As you may know, there are a lot of legal law firms, private law firms that do these employment cases. And so because individual complainants can get monetary compensation and importantly can get attorney's fees. And so you have high-end individuals who can hire their own private firms, private lawyers. You have folks who are poor, middle income, a middle class who can also hire lawyers, and the lawyers can get either they have a contingency fee arrangement or they can recover most of their attorney's fees if they're successful in litigating the cases. It's the low wage workers that are not able to get representation because from the vantage of some private law firms, there isn't a lot of money to be made, and those cases are not as high profile, at least from their perspective. So it's important for us that we give voice to those individuals. So that's definitely one very clear criteria that we deploy, is that it has to be on behalf of folks who are low-wage workers, and low-wage workers in certain industries that are disproportionately ones where the Latinx and African-American population, Latinx mostly, the Latinx population are really high, overrepresented in. So the hospitality industry, for example, and construction, at least for men, are two industries that have really high percentages of Latinx workers. So the pregnancy discrimination case that I alluded to earlier was really on behalf of a low-wage worker who worked in the hospitality industry. So she sort of satisfied those two requirements, and she was also limited English proficient.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That makes total sense. So let's move on to your discussion about housing and economic justice.
So in the housing sphere, we're still sort of tweaking some of the work that we are undertaking. But more recently, we looked at government policies and practices that tend to have a disproportionate impact on the Latinx population. So I'll give you one example. During the prior administration, they had proposed, fortunately never became law, but they proposed a rule that would have required heads of households that are undocumented to leave public housing. And so you can imagine that heads of households the federal housing subsidies does not inure to the benefit of folks who are undocumented. So if you let's assume you have someone who's undocumented and has two U.S. Born children, those two U.S. born children get the federal subsidy. The undocumented person has to pay their share of their housing benefits. So we're talking about folks who live in public housing or have a Section 8 voucher or get some other kind of federally subsidized housing benefit. And so the last administration proposed this rule that would have required all heads of households who are undocumented or who don't have a valid immigration status to be move out of public housing. And so we investigated that particular proposed rule. Well, first we objected to the rule, made public comments to the rule, and then considered litigating if the rule had actually been promulgated on the basis that that particular provision, that rule as proposed, would have disproportionately adversely impacted Latinx households, who comprise almost 90% of individuals who live in mixed immigration status households in most of the federally subsidized programs. So that's one example of, you know, the kind of housing work that we contemplate is when government rules and practices have a disproportionate adverse impact. And the tool we tend to rely on is another civil rights statute, which is Title VIII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits housing discrimination, just the same way that Title VII prohibits employment discrimination.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting work in terms of economic justice that you all are doing. And it appears to me that in the cases that you discussed, that it can have a profound effect across the nation and in various communities. So, you're with Latino Justice, which is an organization that focuses on litigation and really working with the law in order to make good change to our society. So, in your final thoughts about economic justice, what do you propose that individuals and organizations and institutions do in order to advance economic justice in the areas of employment, education, and housing? Your three pillars. You have any calls to action that you would suggest for people? Because I believe that we're all in a place to use our platforms to advance causes and issues. And if you would give any advice for our listening audience, what would you encourage them to do, to act? How would you encourage them to act?
I think in the education sphere, I'd like to see individuals, particularly families that have students in the public school systems, you know, engage in a letter campaign to their local elected officials, sort of pushing the notion or advancing or calling attention to the disparities in the elite school systems, of the fact that, again, in New York City, only 11% of African American and Latinx students have the opportunity to be in these elite schools. So a call to action, a campaign to urge the local elected officials to pay particularized attention to diversity issues and determine a way to sort of bring folks to the table, bring the African-American, Latinx, Asian-American, and white populations to the table to sort of talk about equitable ways to share this public good. So that is one suggestion. It doesn't, I mean, you know, this is happening, this dynamic is sort of playing out in different parts of the country. So to the extent that folks can sort of engage in that kind of a campaign to have their voices highlight, amplify this particular issue to their local elected officials, that would be, I think, helpful. In the employment sphere, I don't necessarily have a call to action right now. I'm not aware of any bill that's pending before state and or the federal legislature to sort of push people to support. But I would say that to the extent that folks are aware of industries that Latinx workers are overrepresented in, and they see patterns of discriminatory practices, to bring those to our attention. Now, I can't promise that we will take all those cases, but to the extent that, you know, folks are aware of continuing and seemingly flagrant discriminatory practices in certain industries, it should bring those to our attention, and we'll, you know, investigate and determine whether or not we have the capacity to bring litigation and or do other kinds of advocacy. Housing, I think I'm gonna I have to do a little more thinking about that to have a call to action.
Thank you. So for those of you who want to use your energy to make a difference in your communities, she has some great advice on doing a letter writing campaign to elected officials in order to bring attention to the issue. But not only that, to elevate your voices and your concerns, because it is through that that you amplify the issues that are most important to you in your communities. And also, she stated that Latino justice could potentially be a resource for you if you identify issues in these areas, in particularly in employment, where it is you have quite a few, a large population of Latino, Latina employees there that are being disproportionately affected by some ways that the employer is operating, that Latino justice could potentially be a resource for you. So with that being said, Fran, or Attorney Fran, even though you don't like that, but Attorney Fran, what, how could our audience get in touch with you if they wanted to speak with you further about the issues you discussed today?
So my contact information is on our website, www.latinojustice.org. And I believe in the contact section of the website, there is a form that you can fill out to send your inquiry or question or comment to me or to one of my colleagues. And we also have, and you could also contact me by phone, 212-219-3360. That's our main number. And your question or inquiry will certainly get to me.
Well, thank you so much, Attorney Francisca Fajana, who's joined us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, knowledge, and expertise with the Empowerment Zone audience. It's been a delight to have you, and continue doing the great work.
Thank you so much, Ramona. I really, really appreciate it. This is my first podcast, so I'm excited and I still have a little bit of a trepidation, but all it's all good.
Yes. Well, I'm happy I'm your first. We're making history today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So today we have Francisca Fajana with us today, and she's going to give us a strategy for college success. Attorney Fran, could you please tell us what school or schools did you attend? What were your major or majors? And then what is that one piece of advice you would give students to ensure that they're successful in college?
So undergrad, I went to undergrad in Nigeria, which is in West Africa. And I went to, my law degree is from Suffolk University, which is in Boston. And I have a master's in law from Boston College as well. One piece of advice to be successful in college: pay attention in class, do your homework, be persistent. And you will be successful.
I love it. Pay attention in class. As a former college professor, some people don't pay attention and then wonder why they didn't do well in the classroom. So pay attention in college. And make sure that you're persistent through the matriculation process, because it takes persistence to complete your education.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for that advice. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ongully, theme song. NADWORKS, digital support. And of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.